The time being 8:15, we will call the meeting of the Health and Human Services Reform Committee to order. I want to remind everyone that we do have session at 10 o'clock this morning, so we will be ending the committee meeting early at about 9:50. We do have quite a list of testifiers today as well, and so the plan is for the next 40 to 45 minutes, we will have Ms. Wilson from the department walk through the Governor's Task Force on Mental Health report, and then from 9 until about 9:45, we will take testimony from those who have shown up. We'll get about 2 minutes apiece for the testifiers, so if you are preparing your remarks yet, try to keep them to about 2 minutes. You can submit things in writing for us as well to review later, but that is all I have for now, and so we do not have a quorum yet, but we will get started. Ms. Wilson, welcome to the committee again, and when you are ready, please start with your report.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Claire Wilson. I am the Assistant Commissioner for the Community Supports Administration at the Department of Human Services, and I am here today to present to you the Governor's Task Force on Mental Health report and recommendations. We do have a robust list of testifiers, and it's a veritable reunion of the Governor's Task Force on Mental Health here in the room today, so partially, I feel like if we just locked the doors in here, we could get this done, really, by noon.
I would recommend
we do that. So who are the individuals who are involved with the task force? Task force membership included individuals and families with lived experience of mental illness, mental health advocates, mental health service providers. That included community mental health providers as well as hospitals, mental health counties, law enforcement, that included courts and corrections, public health, education, housing, legislatures, and commissioners, and the task force was chaired by DHS Commissioner Piper. There you have in your slide presentation there a list of the membership. As I said, it was chaired by Commissioner Piper. Sue Adverholden from NAMI served. You can go on through the list there. It included, of course, Representative Roz Peterson, Representative Clark Johnson, Senators Lori and Senators Rosen, and the Ombudsman for Mental Health, Roberta Oppheim. Now, the charge from the governor was quite extensive. It was to develop comprehensive recommendations to design, implement, and sustain a full continuum of mental health services. And the task force was charged with making recommendations on the continuum of care, the roles and responsibilities for governance, reforms to support timely transitions of care, and then really expanding the capacity to serve diverse communities and cultures. The process was that the task force met 7 times between July and November of 2016, so a very challenging timeline to meet a very large scope and charge. The first few meetings were really devoted to hearing from people with lived experience and to developing vision and principles to guide their work. They then took the scope of the charge and broke it down really into 5 different formulation teams. So that included 2 teams to really look at immediate concerns, so acute inpatient care capacity and our crisis response, and then 3 larger transformational goals of looking at the continuum of care, a cultural lens to address care, and then the governance of the mental health structure. These 5 formulation teams met outside of the formal task force meetings. They also received input from stakeholders and then all came back together and developed a set of recommendations as the full task force. Consensus was reached on all 9 recommendations included in the report. And then the report was delivered to the governor in mid-November. So that was the process. As I said, staff prepared an overview and other background documents. We had 7 meetings. There was a public comment period included in each meeting. And then as I reviewed the formulation teams. Now, it was really important to the task force that there be a robust stakeholder engagement process because this was a large scope, and, of course, not everybody could be at the table. So there was a list of over 350 stakeholders that was maintained, and so those stakeholders were sent agendas and documentation. There was a public website established that contained all the content that the task force reviewed. Stakeholder comments were collected and sent out to the task force. There was a public comment period included in each meeting. And then something that was really important to the task force was making sure that it was meeting in locations across the state. Because as we know, the mental health system has been developed with not enough access across the state. And it doesn't mirror physical health care, right? So if you have a heart attack in Glencoe or you have a heart attack in the heart of Minneapolis, the response is going to be the same, essentially. You'll have the same treatment in the emergency room. The same protocols will be followed during surgery. There'll be the same discharge and rehab options. The same is not true of a mental health crisis. And so the task force recognized that and really went out into communities to hear from people with lived experience. They met in Duluth and in Cambridge and in Rochester and in St. Paul. And so stakeholder comments were discussed within the formulation teams. They were discussed at the larger task force, and that feedback and engagement really helped shape the recommendations that were eventually submitted. So that brings us to the final report and recommendations. Now, it was important to the task force that they develop a vision to help direct their work. And this vision was both informed by the micro-level experience of people with lived experience so that the task force could really approach developing a system that was responsive to those needs. And this vision really recognizes the expectations of those people's needs. And I think it's worth, I know we have limited time, but I think it's actually really worth reading this vision statement because it informs the work of the task force. And it says Minnesota will have a comprehensive, sustainable mental health continuum of care that includes mental health promotion and prevention, early intervention, basic clinical treatment, inpatient and residential treatment, community supports and crisis response services to promote resiliency and recovery. These services and activities will be person and family centered, integrated, and I should mention here that integrated includes both primary care and integrated with addiction treatment. Culturally responsive, timely, and community based. It will rely on public-private partnerships to meet the mental health needs of all Minnesotans in order to help them live, work, learn, participate in community life, and reach their full potential. So the task force identified the following principles then to guide that work. And that's a long list of principles, and I do encourage you to review them. I won't go through them all, but you'll see right at the top is anti-stigma. And, you know, the task force recognized that we have moved through generations of stigma that have been attached to mental illness and addiction, and that stigma has directly impacted both our public policy, our funding, and the way that mental health and addiction are treated within the larger health systems. And so recognizing that the driving principles really need to be that we're moving mental illness and addiction into disease models, that there are treatments that are effective, and that recovery can be achieved. And so that's achieved through all these different principles, including, as mentioned in the vision, person and family-centered, culturally responsible, making sure that it's accessible, making sure that it prevents or reduces or even eliminates involvement with the criminal justice system. And I think you'll see this list of principles really reflected in all of the recommendations. So then we do move to the first recommendation. And this recommendation really serves as the core sort of center of the recommendation, and or all of the recommendations. And this was to create a comprehensive continuum of care. So as has been discussed and will continue to be discussed, the mental health system has not been fully developed yet. And there has been a large amount of attention and investment in the more intensive interventions because this is where crisis occurs. This is where the collapse of earlier identification and mental health promotion occurs. And so really the task force looked at what would we need as a state to develop a full continuum that allowed for accessibility across the state, that recognize that mental health activities should include mental health promotion, that should include prevention, that there should be resources devoted throughout the continuum and also devoted to substance abuse disorder and to primary care, and making sure that these are all integrated. And here is a map that you can see. And this map, the task force did recommend that the legislature and governor consider when they are making changes to the mental health system or working to build up the mental health system. And this includes, again, that coordination between primary care, housing, education, employment, transportation, and really all of that built on this foundation of equal attention to and access to everything from promotion to outpatient treatment to inpatient treatment to services that are provided outside of that. So once this continuum is considered, we have to also consider how that system is going to be governed. So the second recommendation from the task force was strengthening the governance of the mental health system. So as I'm sure you're aware, we currently have a state-funded, state-directed, county-administered system. And this really grew out of deinstitutionalization when people were moved into the community, regions became responsible for the care of those individuals. And this governance model has been really effective in terms of allowing us to be responsible or responsive to regional needs. But as we've moved more from a service-oriented to a healthcare-oriented approach to mental illness and addiction, this has complicated the funding streams. And the task force recognized that we need to really look into governance and accountability, where services are being built, who is responsible for that, and then really who is assuring that we have access and who is defining and responsible for safety net roles. So as you can see, the task force recommended that a governance work group be convened and that it be facilitated by a contractor so that there is a neutral party helping to facilitate some of these very complex questions around how the system should be governed. And this work group would also look at aligning funding mechanisms, as I said, responsibilities and accountability for the overall health of the system. The third recommendation recognizes that in order to have a strong continuum, it must be responsive to the needs of all Minnesotans. And demographics are changing in Minnesota. We also have communities which have traditionally been underserved by the mental health system. That includes American Indian communities, communities of color, LGBTQ Minnesotans, our veterans, and others who have, you know, while the system has progressed, and Minnesota has certainly made advancements in the availability of mental health care, there are still disparities across the state culturally. And so the task force recommended that there be strategies developed to support culturally specific providers. We know that we have a workforce shortage across the spectrum, but we in particular have a lack of culturally specific providers. And as the task force heard in public comment, it is important to have providers who can reflect some lived experience back to the people they are serving. There's also recognition that many of these communities have experienced significant trauma, including our refugee and immigrant communities, our veterans, and that our system really needs to be more trauma-informed to respond to those needs. And then, of course, that there are certain approaches to mental health and to mental illness that have specific roots in cultural practice, and that there are ways in which our mental health system can be strengthened by more culturally informed practices. The fourth recommendation is to develop a mental health workforce. And so this, of course, the task force recognized that workforce challenges are actually the most daunting to establishing that continuum of care. And it's both, you know, we talk about the lack of availability of workforce, but it's also an aging of the workforce. 55% of our psychiatrists, or over half, are over the age of 55. So no offense to anyone over the age of 55, but we really need to young up that profession. So But the task force also recognized, really throughout its recommendations, that there's been a complex ecosystem of bodies and advisory councils and others making recommendations regarding the mental health system, and it's no different with the workforce. So really their major recommendation here was to build on the directive by the 2013 legislature to MNSCU to convene a summit to look at the mental health workforce. That summit then came back with a workforce plan, the Gearing Up for Action, a mental health workforce plan for Minnesota. So the task force recognized that a lot of good work and a lot of thought had been put into that plan, and they recommended that those recommendations continue to be considered and implemented. The next recommendation addresses achieving parity. So I'm sure you all are familiar with the parity laws, which considers mental health to be treated the same as any physical health condition. Now, the complication of parity is that it says that if an insurance plan covers it, then it must also cover the mental health component. So if the insurance covers, you know, unlimited outpatient services after a cardiac surgery, then it must provide unlimited mental health outpatient services after a crisis, you know, just as an example. However, the complication of that is, of course, that there are many different plans. It is very difficult to enforce with the multiplicity of network adequacy. So recognizing this, the task force recommended that the Department of Commerce and Health expand their capacity to review existing insurance plans and to make sure that they are aligning with parity laws and that there are mechanisms to enforce those laws. And this included really recommending that the state should require that private insurance cover the same benefits that are covered under Minnesota's Medicaid plans and MinnesotaCare. And that, of course, we have a comprehensive model mental health benefit set that was developed by the Mental Health Action Group after years of work. And so really looking at those benefits and making sure that they're standardized across our insurance coverage mechanisms will be very important to promoting more standardized benefits and assuring access and coverage across the system. So again, assuring that we're achieving that continuum by assuring coverage and parity. The sixth recommendation speaks to the early part of the continuum, or promoting mental health and preventing mental illness. Now, this speaks to really supporting efforts to build robust mental health promotion and prevention capacity. It tasks the Department of Health with treating mental health and resiliency and well-being as a directive for a public campaign, so that we are continuing to educate people about the impact and the importance of mental health. And it also is noting that because of the high human and financial costs of mental illness, that we be sure to put capacity into communities to define their own gaps and barriers and allow them to help inform how public strategies should address prevention and promotion. And they also recommended that that the state continue to address adverse childhood experiences and really trauma throughout the lifespan. So, again, this is a recommendation that will be largely living or directed towards the Minnesota Department of Health. The seventh recommendation is achieving housing stability. And I, you know, as an observer of the task force, the public comment period almost always involves some discussion of housing stability and how foundational it is to achieving mental well-being and recovery. This was the recommendation around which the task force reached consensus the earliest. And it really includes not just making sure that there's access to affordable housing, but that whenever possible we're integrating supports and services into that housing in a way that allows people to maintain their housing and sustain recovery through that. And also, the task force also recommended looking at our current income supports, such as Minnesota Supplemental Assistance and Group Residential Housing, and making sure that they're individualized and allowing for people to afford those homes, and also that, again, those supports and services are also equitably accessed. And as I said, the task force felt strongly that this is going to really lead to a more effective mental health care system. The last two recommendations that I'll cover are the recommendations centered around our more short-term recommendations for immediate action around two areas that the state is facing increasing pressure. And the first was short-term improvements to our acute care capacity. And I think it is worth noting this first bullet on your slide, which is that to fund several short-term solutions to the patient flow problems implicit in the shortage of inpatient psychiatric beds. And this is important for several reasons. It highlights that this is not just a question of whether or not we have built up enough inpatient bed capacity, but it's a question of where are we feeling or where is the state system feeling pressure around how community capacity has been built up, around how people are being discharged, why they're continually having to stay in hospital level of care when they no longer need hospital level of care. So, for instance, we know that people are brought to the emergency room when they're in a mental health crisis, when perhaps they could be accessing community-based services, which might be more effective, but which not everybody is aware of, or around which there are challenges to building up. So, for example, intensive residential treatment services, or IRTSs. Now, if you're not fluent in the world of the mental health system, you may not even know what an IRTS is. But everybody knows what chemo is to treat cancer. So it's really important that community capacity is built up and awareness of those treatment services are built up and that that barriers are eliminated to access. For instance, to create new IRTSs or new assertive community treatment teams, a contract is required with the counties, and that can sometimes create burdens in terms of capacity building. The task force also recommended that reforms to our addiction treatment system would help decrease the pressure. Over 11% of people in hospital beds who no longer meet hospital level of care are waiting discharge to treatment services. So assuring that there is more direct access to treatment services, that there is more care coordination built into our addiction system service, that withdrawal management is well covered. These were all components of ensuring that we're getting the flow corrected. The task force also looked at the impact of the increase to the counties in their share, so of paying for their residents who are in state-operated facilities such as the Anoka Regional Treatment Center or the Community Behavioral Health Hospitals. So when a patient is in these facilities and no longer requires a hospital level of care, the counties begin to pay full share for that stay. Now, those monies go into the general fund, and so the task force did recommend looking at if there are different ways to imagine how that money can be utilized to support the continuum and the building of the mental health system and increasing capacity. So those were some short-term recommendations. They also looked at expanding options for parents and children and then supporting children's residential treatment. So, again, there are many factors creating pressures around the flow of patients throughout the state, and these are some short-term recommendations to decreasing that pressure, increasing flow, and best utilizing the capacity that we have available for inpatient beds. The final recommendation was around short-term improvements to our crisis response system. So, again, the task force was really envisioning a day when this treatment of a stroke is the same as the treatment of a mental health crisis. And there are multiple barriers that are faced to achieving this or have been built into achieving this. One is that someone experiencing a mental health crisis, it can get escalated, and you know, law enforcement is frequently called in. Law enforcement is trained to assess a situation for safety, mitigate risk. there are often very few options for where law enforcement can eventually transport someone. So someone in an escalated state may be taken to an emergency room, which is not the most therapeutic environment for someone who's experiencing a crisis. They may need to be taken to a jail because of the, you know, level of their behavior. Again, not the most therapeutic environment for someone in a mental health crisis. And again, there are mobile mental health crisis services available in the state, and we are working towards 24 and achieving, you know, access to those services across the state. But not everyone's educated about those services. You know, if you're a family member and you're in crisis, you're going to call 911. They may not always connect you to a mobile crisis team. So there's multiple challenges built in. And the task force really recognized that it's going to take training of law enforcement around crisis intervention. It's going to take more resources where people are already seeking help, that there needs to be better collaboration between mental health and criminal justice, and that there needs to be able to be increased data sharing and collaboration between these entities. And there is a lot of opportunity around telehealth and how you could utilize, particularly in areas where it's very difficult to access psychiatry services or even, you know, a counselor. And if there's opportunities for someone even to be engaged over the phone or remotely with someone until someone can arrive in person. So really looking at how we can leverage telehealth and then further improvements to community services. So building up assertive community treatment teams that can work in jails, making sure that we have enough crisis stabilization services throughout the state. The task force really considered crisis response as well as improvements to acute care capacity as areas where we need these short-term recommendations to be implemented as soon as possible. Now, I just wanted to take a minute finally here at the end just to talk about these recommendations, how they build on some of the progress that has already been made and some of the investments already made, particularly in 2015. So some of these are just some of the highlights from that package and a little bit of an update around where we are with these and how they can support the recommendations of the task force. As I mentioned, the mobile mental health crisis services are now available statewide. Our next step is to have them available 24/7 by 2018. The state is in the process of implementing behavioral health homes, which are a model for coordinating primary and mental health care. Recommendations that came from the workforce plan, some of those have been implemented, including loan forgiveness for mental health professionals practicing in rural areas and with underserved communities. The state has been working to expand the quality of our assertive community treatment teams across Minnesota and also enhancing the availability of those in the criminal justice system. There have been startup grants to establish new residential crisis services. There's been expansion of the Children's Mental Health Respite Care grants. There's been expansion of Housing with Support grants. In the last few months, we've been rolling out first episode psychosis services and supports, again, critical to ensuring that people who are having their first episode or their first symptoms of severe mental illness are receiving the treatment they need as soon as they need it and when they need it. You know, we do not wait for cancer to reach stage 4 before we treat it. Schooling mental health grants, which have been incredibly successful at reaching children, again, sort of with a similar notion where they are, when they need it, where they're most the most accessible. The state is in the process of establishing psychiatric residential treatment facilities and hoping to have those up by or having those up by July. And then the last one that I'll just highlight on this map are the certified community behavioral health clinics. So earlier this year, the state was awarded one of 8 national pilots to pilot these certified community behavioral health clinics, which will serve as one-stop shops to provide integrated primary chemical and mental health care. And these are rooted in community mental health centers, so with the providers who really are the most trained in responding to mental illness and being able to coordinate that care with other systems across the state. You can see here that they will be in the northwestern part of the state, in Crookston with the Northwestern Mental Health Center, near Brainerd with Northern Pines Mental Health Center, down in Rochester with Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center, and then in the metro area, People Incorporated, Ramsey County, and Wilder Children and Family Services. These clinics are by no means the ultimate solution to the challenges that we're facing and by no means will fill all the gaps in the continuum, but it is 2 years where the state can really examine how providing coordinated and integrated care can impact the mental well-being across Minnesota. I know that we have a long list of testifiers who can speak better to these, some of these recommendations even than I can. But that's a brief overview of the task force work and their report to the governor.
Assistant Commissioner Wilson, thank you for your presentation this morning. We do have a quorum now, so I'll call the meeting to order. Representative Kreisha moves the January 12th minutes after he has reviewed them. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes that need to be made to the minutes? Seeing nothing, all those in favor of adopting the minutes from January 12, 2017, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. We have about 12, 15 minutes for questions for Assistant Commissioner Wilson. First on the list was Representative Murphy. If she comes back in, we'll grab her. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Wilson, for your presentation. I just want to thank everyone who participated in this on these recommendations and committee. Obviously, mental illness is a crisis situation in many families, and my extended family is not immune from having problems in those areas. I'm sure just like everybody else's. But I do have just a question about the study. You know, I spent a number of years in jail ministry, not in jail, but jail ministry. They let me out every night. No, and also I was on the school board for a long time. So I've observed the implementation of psychological techniques on people who are hurting and have mental illness problems or addictions. And was there any consideration, you know, I'm all for spending some money to help with these, help these people here. But was there any consideration given to the effectiveness of the programs that we're going to fund to help people who are suffering from mental illness and addictions? For, in other words, a high success rate versus and a low recidivism rate versus programs that show little if any success and a very high recidivism rate? I didn't see that in your recommendations that organizations that would participate would have to show some type of credibility in terms of effectiveness in dealing with these people.
Assistant Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grun, that is really addressed more fully in the governance recommendation, where the task force really considered how effectiveness, accountability, making sure that there's strong data collection and analysis of different components of the system are considered.
Mr. Chair.
A follow-up, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. And the reason I throw that or make this suggestion for people to consider, you know, again, I'm not an expert, okay? I am an insurance salesman, which may qualify for mental illness help from time to time. But especially for the people who see their health insurance premiums. They have high emotional problems.
Sure, the report, Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah. Anyway, but what I've observed is that so many of the techniques used in modern-day psychology actually don't work and, in fact, make things worse for many of the patients, and that's a major concern of mine. Now, again, I've referenced and read certain materials and information, and one of the best I can recommend to people is the book by that was co-authored by a former president of the APA called The Destructive Trends in Mental Health, The Well-Intentioned Path to Harm. You can order it online. I think it would be a good reference for people in the mental health area because the majority of techniques promoted in modern-day psychology don't work and actually make things worse, according to this former president of the APA. The one of the things he implicates is the overuse of psychotropic drugs. They can be used as a short-term gap, but they shouldn't be used long-term with the consequences, especially on young children. The other thing he shows as something very effective, which isn't rarely used nowadays, is talk therapy, just sitting down and talking through the difficulties and problems with people, which is time-consuming. So I, you know, just to wrap up my comments, one other thing, I obtained a presentation by Dr. Anthony Coppola, who has a PhD in the social sciences a number of years ago. And one of the things he shared in his presentation is the Hans-Eismick study, which you can also find online. And Hans-Eismick was the first study, it was done I think in the 70s, that actually looked at the effectiveness of modern-day psychology techniques in terms of helping people recover. And there were three statistics that the Hans-Eismick shared. And if you go to a psychotherapist and you're mentally and emotionally disturbed, you have like a 34% chance of being straightened out mentally and emotionally after 1 year. If you go to a psychoanalyst, you've got like a 52% chance of being straightened out mentally and emotionally after 1 year. If you go to a psychiatrist who can prescribe medication, you've got like a 63% chance of being straightened out mentally and emotionally after 1 year. But if you don't go to anybody at all and just do talk therapy, you got a 74% chance of being straightened out mentally and emotionally after 1 year. So, you know, according to Dr. Anthony Coppola and the Hans-Eismick study, modern-day psychology techniques actually are regressive to people recovering. And that's why I'm very concerned as a legislator that we not only spend money on this area, but do it in a way that we promote effective organizations with high success rates such as AA, Teen Challenge, and other organizations that promote this idea of a higher power outside yourself. So just food for thought. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the Commissioner for your presentation today and for the committee who came together for the recommendation. I have two questions, and I just want to open up to say that this summer I had the opportunity to work with a young man who showed up at my house who had been homeless for 2 years and had been diagnosed and is still diagnosed with acute psychosis, schizophrenia, paranoid, and he's 22 years old, which I hear that is at the height when these began to become present. And it's tough. It's tough trying to help and support because reasoning does not work. But we also have policies in practice in the data privacy area that states that if they do not want mental services, mental health services, that we cannot force them, right? So often you're mentally ill, but you don't believe that you are, right? Which is really, can be really, really complicated in trying to get them the support that they need. And so what I found through my personal experience of trying to help and support this young man is that it is very complicated, and the system is very complicated, like overwhelmingly complicated. And using this process, what I would call a holistic process, where you're looking at housing, mental health, and all the other services that needed to be coordinated to get an individual to a place where they can get the services that they need, if they can, you know, one, realize that they need the services, and two, to have the resources available for them to utilize the services that they need. So, you know, I understand, Representative Grunhagen, in your analysis of having services available that can really support individuals who are struggling with mental illness, and how we in this body can create the necessary you know, and resources they would take, which is huge. Mm-hmm. You know, unlimited dollars would be awesome. But the need is huge in so, so many different areas. And so I think my first question would be definitely around the shortage of social workers that we that is there, and looking at the lack of culturally specific social workers, and trying to tie that into our school system, right? Because there's definitely a shortage within our school system with social workers in general, but also having that culturally specific social worker. Okay, so can you speak to that in any way?
Assistant Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, first of all, thank you for sharing that story and for naming how complex the system is. And as we know, over 55% of people who experience homelessness are also experiencing a severe mental illness. And so there is a myriad of ways that really addressing the full continuum helps us support them. And implementing evidence-based informed practices that we know work because they are, you know, evidence-based, and building on those begin to help address that. The lack of cultural providers is something that was also deeply considered by the workforce summit that was convened to put together that workforce plan. And there was a lot of discussion around that table about doing training programs much earlier on, so getting into schools that have diverse demographics and really promoting social work, promoting mental health as a field, which is both viable and which provides an avenue for growth. You know, it also, that group also deeply considered the need for career ladders and making sure that people could see advancement opportunities mm-hmm. throughout their professional experience. And also just recognizing that we need more culturally specific providers to go out and speak to youth and to those who might be engaged in that program. We certainly, as a state, have put some time and energy into recruiting people into the sciences and to become doctors, and that work group did note that equal attention needed to be paid to the social work and social science fields.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, when we look at this whole cultural piece, I was working with a social worker last session who has worked in the field for like 20, 25 years, have numerous degrees, very professional, an African-American woman who was trying to, as you talk about school social workers, is trying to find a way to create access for social workers who have been out in the field but don't have maybe the some of the requirements to be a school social worker, to find a way and a pathway to utilize these social workers of color who are out in the community, who have, you know, private practices, who have the knowledge and experience to find a pathway into our school system to really address the need of our students. I know personally in the African-American community, when you want to deal with mental health, there's a stigma attached to that, right? And we are not readily open to self-identifying that someone has a mental illness. But we know, as we look at, you know, ACEs and childhood experiences and trauma and the impact that that have on learning and development, creating a pathway to have more social workers in our school system is vital. So do you have any, can you speak to that?
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, the report does speak, of course, to building community capacity around mental health promotion and recovery, which also had a focus on talking about working within communities to increase their capacity, and that included increasing capacity for, again, looking at avenues into social work. And then, of course, we know through our schooling mental health grants that linking the schools with mental health providers has mm-hmm. been incredibly successful. And there is still, you know, there are no sort of solutions recommended in the report that I can recall. Someone can correct me. Directly addressing, you know, school social workers. But the task force did hear from school social workers. And just like the rest of the spectrum of services, the need for more culturally specific providers in the schools.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Great overview. I want to thank you and all the members that served on this great task force. I'm looking forward to the recommendations, taking some further steps, especially number two. Again, I also just seeing firsthand the challenges that our only state hospital in Wilmer with the children's hospital, the kids and adolescent CABS, otherwise known as, has been sort of bled with funds and moved them around to other direct care services, and it has been really a challenge, and so I'm really happy to see the governance of this can be relooked at. It is something that is, I think, grossly misled and misused at times because, again, of the focus and the pressures of other things. One question I wanted to ask you, though, was you said that the counties that are paying for these residents that are not now getting hospital care in the state's hospitals like Anoka and such goes into the general fund. You know, roughly what kind of dollars are we talking about that goes into the general fund from the counties that you were maybe thinking that we could look at in the future of how to maybe reutilize those funds? Any idea what that might be?
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, I don't currently have a number, but we are working on trying to isolate that number. It's a complicated formula, of course, but it is, you know, in the millions of dollars.
Follow-up, Representative Baker?
One quick, and then just, again, I'm looking forward to following up with some other addiction questions that I have offline. Maybe we can meet in my office at some point, but great work on this. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, like others, I first of all want to commend the people who worked on the task force because it was a huge lift in a really short time frame and pretty exciting stuff because I think everybody knows that we need to make improvements, and it's great to have this first step. I first wanted to comment kind of back to what Representative Grunhagen was talking about. You know, ideally we should do everything evidence-based, right? And we did pass, either last year or the year before, I know Representative Mack and I had worked on this initiative called Results First, and it was funded in the department, I think it's in MMB actually, but for members who may not know, this is an initiative that's meant to set up some methods for us to use evidence to evaluate programs. And I would like to, first of all, just ask Assistant Commissioner if you could give us any kind of update on that, if you know, to kind of tell us, maybe remind members a little better than I am, what it is and what's coming for us.
Assistant Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that study was conducted by MMB based on national studies of our evidence-based practices that are put into place in Minnesota. I do believe that they will be providing an overview for you all of the results of that study. And it did look at the cost-effectiveness of providing those services. So why are we getting the state's return on investment based on the what the evidence is and the outcomes of those programs. I don't want to steal the thunder from MMB about what the results of those were, but we have seen a preview of that and did see that many of the evidence-based practices that the state is currently implementing are resulting in both cost-effectiveness and good outcomes for the people we're serving.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. We'll look forward to seeing that because we know that as important as it is to use evidence where evidence exists, the evidence needs to be evaluated. So, you know, it's there are many examples of people putting forward something called evidence, which is completely false. So you need to have a really good evaluation of what you're using, and hopefully this is a system that's going to do that. My other question, though, is when I had first read the results here, what was really striking to me, I have to say I was just a bit disappointed, maybe foolishly, because maybe I expected way, way too much. I'm sure I did, because this was a really heavy lift, really short timeline. It's not very specific. And so that's where I was, because I was thinking, oh, we're going to get these, somebody's going to tell us, what should we do next? And of course, that was too much to expect. But my question to you is, you know, what is the next, how do we move forward with this? Because there's so much here. And there are a lot of things that really need to be made more specific. And as many people probably know, this our process here is it's difficult to do that. We need somebody to come forward and say, you know, here's the bill. Here's the next piece. And I'm wondering if that is going to come from your department or, you know, what do you as an assistant commissioner in this area kind of plan to do with this? How are you going to help us all move forward with the great ideas and suggestions we have in this document.
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. So this was a high-level overview of the report. There are some specific recommendations, but you are correct in that this is an incredibly complex and challenging task ahead of us to build a system that has not yet been built. And so as an administration, of course, the department is you know, really looking at this continuum that is being recommended to support the work. But this is probably a great segue into our testifiers because the report does discuss that this is going to be a collaboration between the state, the counties, health systems, advocates, public health, corrections. There, you know, the entire state, almost every level of our systems has some stake in building this up. And so it really is going to be the responsibility of many private and public entities to ensure that this map and this vision is fulfilled.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, just finally. So absolutely. I mean, we know, and actually one of the great things about this task force is that it's so collaborative across these sectors, but we know that it takes leadership to pull these things together and kind of keep it on track. And I just really, really hope that we're going to be able to continue that because there is so much here that there's no time to waste. Thank you very much.
All right, members, and we've gone about 8 minutes over in the presentation area. I do have a few more people on the list for questions. I have Representative Sandsteed, Peterson, and Cagle. If you can ask your questions quickly, and then we'll get to the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wilson, my background is in education, and specifically I'm curious in hearing a little bit about the lack of or the shortfall of pediatric mental health services, specifically in rural Minnesota. I think it's absolutely a step in the right direction to be putting social workers in schools. But what are we doing outside of schools to meet those needs for our youngest students and children?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, the maturation of the children's mental health system is even, you know, less fully developed than the adult mental health system. There have been, you know, as I mentioned, a few things that the state is implementing that addresses children's mental health, including new levels of residential care. There is also currently a rate study being conducted so that the state can begin to understand what our continuum of services are and how they're being reimbursed to really allow us to see if there are barriers to our payment mechanisms that are preventing the development of services, and that includes in children's services. But, you know, the children's mental health services, just like the adult mental health services, are just not as available in rural areas. And that is a correct observation that schools are not going to be the only solution for that, but schooling mental health has allowed us to provide those services for, you know, to reduce travel time, which is one of the big concerns in rural Minnesota, of course.
Follow-up, Representative?
Just one more question. In your opinion, if more time resources were invested on the front end, in the pediatric end, do you feel that that would pay off in dividends later on.
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. I was able to serve on this task force, and I just want to thank the governor for compiling it and all the many people that served on that task force. Obviously, we've all been probably touched personally at some level with people who are experiencing mental illness issues. And I just wanted to reflect a little bit that as policymakers, this isn't probably a one-size-fits-all. We have lots of very different communities, whether it's in greater Minnesota or right here in the metropolitan area. And so we need to make sure that we look at things as an individualized solution that is that allows a lot of flexibility and things of that nature. So as we all know, that the brain is a very complex place, and we have a lot of work to be done. But there will be a couple of bills that will be coming forward very shortly. One is addressing some of the capacity with the beds for children. In fact, I looked on the Minnesota Access Health Access website, and there are no beds available for any children under the age of 12. And so those are some short-term solutions, but we also have to look at the backlog and the housing components as well. Another piece is some flexibility about with funding and some discharge options. So look forward to serving with you guys and talking more about this issue further.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. The honor of the final question today, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wilson, a lot of times I'm looking at specifically recommendation number 6, a lot of times mental health and drug addiction and trouble with the law come crashing together at one time. And when you're looking to kind of prevent some of those situations, there usually has to be a strong support system around people who are dealing with these issues to recognize that they need help and to intervene early before all of those three things come crashing together. And so has there been any look into how to help people who don't have that support system around them and to help them, you know, prevent some of these issues before they really become a bigger problem?
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is, you're right, that is correct, that this recommendation really does talk about building up the infrastructure of community to respond to an individual's needs. So one of the directives is to make sure that community is not only involved in, you know, recognizing when someone is in crisis, but building up what mental health looks like, building resiliency into, like, our thinking around how we promote mental wellness. And that includes making sure that law enforcement and schools, you know, and other supports are informed about that. And there is certainly a recognition within this report and within that recommendation that our informal supports are just as important as our supports, and that educating those informal supports is part of the continuum.
A follow-up, Representative Cagle. All right. Well, thank you, Assistant Commissioner Wilson, for your presentation today and taking our questions. This will not be, members, the last time we talk about this issue, as I'm sure you could put together from the amount of interest that we have here. And so we'll come back to it time and time again throughout the session, I'm sure. Again, members, we have until 9:50 this morning, and then we have to rush over to the floor in order to have session there. And so we're going to move swiftly through the testifiers that we have today. We are going to go in order on the sheet that was for the agenda for today. And so if testifiers want to line up, you have about 2 minutes for each presentation. And again, if you do have further commentary that you want to submit to the committee, please feel welcome to do so. But welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nathan Gove. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, commonly referred to as the POST Board. We are the state's regulatory agency that licenses approximately 12,000 peace officers across our state, and we establish the education, selection, licensing, and training standards for law enforcement agencies and their officers. Specifically, concerning education standards, the board certifies the 29 professional peace officer education programs located throughout our state at 35 locations. These programs provide the pre-service education for those entering the law enforcement profession. Prior to my service with the Pulse Board, I was a peace officer in Minnesota for nearly 29 years, and I have seen firsthand countless times the lack and the continuity of care for persons suffering from mental illness, the variations in the resources and access available to assist these families, and law enforcement's limited options for redirecting these individuals with mental illness away from the judicial system and into the healthcare system where they belong. And I would just say, sadly, these events tend to take place on in the middle of the night on weekends where some of the mobile crisis teams are either overwhelmed or unavailable. So having 24-hour access for a patrol officer, especially in greater Minnesota, is critical to redirect these people away from the criminal justice system and the stigma that goes with that. I want to just quickly focus my comments on the task force recommendation to build the crisis intervention team, CIT, skills and experience into pre-service law enforcement education. This is recommendation number 9. The Pulse Board has heard testimony quite recently from representatives of the Minnesota CIT Officers Association, and I know one of their board members is here to testify, as well as our education providers that tell us that specialized 40-hour CIT certification is not appropriate for pre-service education and training to candidates who have not even made their first real traffic stop or pinned on the badge or even been hired by a law enforcement agency. They lack the experience and the context to integrate these skills.
Mr. Grove?
Yes, sir.
I had spent 2 minutes. I'm sorry.
All right. I'll just wrap up by saying the documents that I've left for you are what the board has responded to of the curriculum that's currently being built by our education providers, and we certainly support the efforts of the task force, but we're just here to tell you that the 40-hour CIT is not the appropriate location before people even become peace officers. Right. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list is Shauna Reitman. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Shauna Reitmeyer, and I am here today wearing 3 hats. One is a member of the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, the other as the CEO of Northwestern Mental Health Center, a rural and frontier community mental health center serving 6 counties in the northwest part of the state, and third is the president of MACMAP, the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and thank you for this opportunity this morning. As a task force member, my colleagues, peers, and I, along with DHS staff, spent many dedicated hours to develop these thoughtful and thorough recommendations. And I feel that with the work that we've done, even though it's only been 7 meetings that we accomplished this work, we've begun to create a roadmap for the future mental health system. As a provider delivering services to over 3,300 community members in my region, I can now feel assured that the vision set forth by this task force is true. My agency's vision is truly now aligned with what the task force has created. I'm not going to reiterate what the assistant commissioner said in terms of what the vision is. You have that in your report. But by now having that vision in front of us, it now gives us, me as an agency, a CEO in making decisions, it gives you as legislators now that vision to move away from the current piecemeal feeling that there seems to be with legislation that's coming forward, and it actually gives us that vision when legislation bills are coming forward to connect those pieces towards as we make decisions. So even though we've only had 7 meetings to create this vision and create these recommendations, there may be gaps. There may be things that were missed or things that we didn't think of. New research comes up. There's new lived experiences. But this gives those new pieces that may not be in those recommendations an opportunity to connect those to what that vision of Minnesota's mental health system can be.
Ms. Reitmeyer, it's been 2 minutes.
Okay. If I could just really quickly. So one of the recommendations that came out of this and that was supported by the task force was the certified community behavioral health clinics. As one of the 6 first implementers in the state of Minnesota that is moving forward to implementing this, The CCBHC demonstration site is one of those that addresses multiple recommendations. It's a comprehensive, coordinated, integrated approach that builds into it an inherent governance structure that has accountability and responsibility to services. It meets the mental health and chemical health needs of children, families, and adults. And this two-year pilot project is something that I think the state of Minnesota can really look at as a potential model to delivering strategies for building this mental health system. I look forward to working with you, with our other stakeholders in our community to continue to grow this vision, and looking forward to ways to make these recommendations come forward and to see how the CCBHC model of care can be sustained within the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Reitmeier. Next, we have Jinlee Palin.
Right. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jinlee Palin. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. Thank you so much for hosting this really important conversation to review the Governor's Task Force on Mental Health recommendations, as well as this opportunity to speak to the committee. And we have supplied a letter to members as well that has some more information on our comments to you all on this. The Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, or MACMEP, is the state's leading association for community mental health programs, representing 36 community-based mental health providers across Minnesota. We serve all who come to us seeking mental and behavioral health services, regardless of their insurance status, ability to pay, or where they live. We are essential community providers and critical to the safety net in the behavioral health system, serving primarily culturally diverse, low-income, uninsured, or public program enrollee Minnesotans. We offer them wraparound services, community-based services with love and coordinated care. We support all nine of the recommendations in the Governor's Task Force, and we're very excited to play an integral role in helping to move some of those forward with some specific initiatives regarding some of the recommendations specifically. I echo my board president, Shauna Reitmeier, in the support of the vision. We are truly grateful and owe you a huge debt of gratitude for your support and passage of the Excellence in Mental Health Demonstration Project last year that allowed the state of Minnesota to submit a proposal to become one of the 8 states to demonstrate the Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics demonstration pilot. We're very excited to work with you, the legislature, our state agencies and industry partners to sustain, evolve, and scale up this new system moving forward. To some of the other recommendations, to recommendations 1 and 5, creating a comprehensive mental health continuum and achieving parity. Again, we support and thank you for the authority to apply to be a CCBHC pilot state. We are excited to work with you on scaling that up. To recommendations 3 and 4, using a cultural lens to reduce mental health disparities in developing the mental health workforce. We'd also refer to the complementary recommendations in the Gear Up for Action Mental Health Workforce Plan in Minnesota and the recently released 2016 Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission final report. We believe a starting place to increase the breadth and diversity of staff to support the provision of much-needed services as well as reflect our changing and growing diverse communities. And we would also support and propose the increase of access to telehealth services. To recommendation 8, to implement short-term improvements to acuity care capacity and especially levels of care transitions. From our perspective, a key piece of this conversation is ensuring community-based services are reimbursed in a way that sustains these much-needed services until a longer-term solution can be implemented. And so we would support and propose some increases to some of those provider rates to make sure that those services can be sustained. And finally, to recommendation number 9, implementing short-term improvements to crisis response. With several of our members providing around-the-clock crisis intervention response services, we very much support this recommendation. And to that end, we are very supportive of any initiatives coming forward to sustain infrastructure backing points of access to crisis response services, including helpline and triage systems. Thank you very much for this opportunity, and we are excited to continue partnering with you moving forward.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Palin, for your testimony. I didn't see Ms. Turner in here. Is she Barb Turner here? No. Next, then, we have Clara Sharp. No. Sharp? Okay. Then next on the list is Melissa Ballitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Melissa Bailitz, and I am the chair of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health, and I was also a representative with personal or family experience with mental illness on the governor's task force. I'll get to the State Advisory Council point first. I have included as a handout to the committee the recommendations that we by statute have to give the governor and legislature every 2 years. Unfortunately, due to the statute, we had to release ours a month before the task force's report this year. But going forward, as invited to us by the task force report, we are going to use the task force report going forward with our recommendations for principles and guidance as we continue to work to build the system. To make some personal points, as I believe I'm the only consumer or family member representative from the task force that is here to speak today, I would say that the number one most important recommendation is to build out the continuum. I would comment on the talk therapy. Would love to have that. It's taken our family 11 years to have weekly talk therapy available to my brother, who has an SPMI, consistently for over 3 months. 11 years. And if you think that MA is paying for it, it's not. They're actually taking sliding fee and taking the loss for the rest. So in terms of access, there's nothing available in the system. There are some, but it's not meeting nearly the capacity that is coming in from everywhere. There are wait lists. You learn to live on wait lists and lines and to switch from provider to provider in order to just get the basic care. Last weekend, on Friday, I went to my brother's 30th birthday party, and I realized as I was about to walk into it that I never thought we would actually have a 30th birthday party for them. Currently, over 300 more people die by suicide every year in the state of Minnesota than in car accidents. That was in 2015. So think in your districts. Every time you hear of a car accident or a vehicle fatality, there's likely one or two other people that have died by suicide in your district in that time. I would say I continue to want to partner with you to work on the future recommendations. As we said, this is kind of an overview and vision document. We will continue to drive to more specific recommendations that work within the system that we're given both from the federal level as well as what the communities are asking for and wanting to be able to build within their communities. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bailiff, for your testimony this morning. Next, we have Chris Cassier. Okay. He's not here. Dr. Paul Gehring?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul Gehring. I'm a psychiatrist. I'm the physician lead for Alliance Mental Health and Addiction Services, member of the task force, and the president-elect of the Minnesota Psychiatric Society. In the spirit of 2 minutes, I'm not going to tell you about how we brought ourselves collectively to the work, which was leaving our hats at the door to imagine community-focused solutions, not organization-focused solutions. I'm not going to tell you about how you might use these 9 recommendations or the roadmap more globally to address requests for legislation and funding. And instead, I'll focus on 2 issues. The first, of the transformative and reform-minded choices we can make, I highly advocate for recommendation number 2, the redesign of governance, page 28 of the formal document. And specifically, I would remind you, we're on a journey that we started in the 60s, moving from institutionally-based care that's provided by and paid for by the state, looking to community-based care where multiple providers are involved. And at current, the governance, which is state-directed and county-administered, while adequate at one time in history, no longer serves that function. Individuals like myself, who are responsible for more mental health care than any other agency in the state, are unable to participate in that governance structure. Governance structure of the future is going to need to have broader representation with shared accountability, both for the quality and the stewardship of resources. So I highly encourage that consideration. Finally, I would share a paradox and a concern. I'm amazed regularly what we can get done in this state when we are single-minded and focused and aligned. I think about what we did 2 years ago in preparedness for Ebola. the amount of time, energy, and effort it took to assure every citizen in every part of the state would be able to have service should that become necessary was truly remarkable. I'd bookend that, however, with the contrast of our mental health system. Right now, in every community, there's great suffering. Every region of the state, every social economic class. And our task force was not the first to generate most of these opinions. What's going to differentiate this work and our efforts in them is what we do with them. And I'm troubled. I'm pondering, and I wonder deeply, how we'll be graded if we apply the moral test of government, remembering that a government's going to be assessed by how they serve those at the dawn of life, you know, the youth, the twilight of life, death, and in the shadows. We're talking about those in the shadows of life, and I fear that we won't be graded well if we don't take action on these particular recommendations at this time in history. Thank you for taking my question.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Gearing, for your testimony. Next, we have Tracine Asbury. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony in 2 minutes.
Thank you, and good morning. My name is Tracine Asbury. I'm the executive director of St. Paul Youth Services. I'm a former Minneapolis public school teacher and also a Minneapolis school board member. Good morning. So I want to say that I'm very encouraged and hopeful by the 2016 final report presentation of the governor's task force. While at the same time, I have, as I shared with the task force, concerns regarding the consideration of racial equity and the treatment of traumas resulting from generational and systemic racism. Once this is acknowledged and accepted, our collective response to these effects must be in proportion to the enormity of the conditions which created them. I believe that the 9 recommendations are moving towards this end. However, in order to respond adequately, we must also acknowledge that our understanding of the complexities of these issues, the conditions that created them, and their impact is limited and biased. So just as at St. Paul Youth Services is turned to for mental health expertise and working with youth, as well as community caregivers, we should also be turning to experts on racial equity and social justice to reform our thinking as we build an equitable mental health care system. So I want to just emphasize, we cannot condition our youth to adapt to discrimination, to poverty, to unequal opportunities. We cannot tell them to be stronger when we use words such as resilience and to have them work harder to overcome these barriers. We must do better than this. A racial equity and social justice expert will bring a critical eye to the language we use and the narrative framework upon which we construct Minnesota's mental health systems. I want to emphasize once again that I believe that the 9 recommendations are moving in this direction, but because we are set in a system that has been very consistent and deliberate, we have to have something stronger, which is why I recommend that overall, with the 9 recommendations, we have an overarching framework that's rooted in racial equity and social justice. Thank you very much, and thank you for your questions this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Asbury, for your testimony. Next, we have Suzanne Kiplinger.
Yes.
All right.
Share these with the committee. Let me just pass these around.
All right, if you could please introduce yourself for the committee and give us your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Kaplinger, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm the director of the Catalyst Initiative at the George Family Foundation. And for the last several years, we've been investing $1 million a year all over the state of Minnesota in helping communities, particularly communities where health disparities are high, both mental health and physical health, in developing trauma-resilient skills, in developing stress coping mechanisms that have meaning within the culture. And what we're learning through these processes is that this works. And this is, to date, a missing component of a continuum of care that can be a low-cost, replicable, sustainable model that can be embedded within communities. We're beginning to track outcomes, and I think particularly the work that we're finding is very pertinent to number one, the continuum of care, number three, the cultural lens, and number six, promoting health and reducing illness. We do know that integrative health practices, those are mind, body, spirit healing. It's faith-centered healing. It can be yoga. It can be ceremony. It can be cultural practices that they actually do work. We understand the impact of trauma and toxic stress on the human body and on our brains and how we think. We think a kid in a high school picks up a chair and throws it across the room is just a bad kid. That kid actually may be exhibiting a trauma reaction. So we have to understand how people can begin to learn to self-regulate using practices that have meaning in community and that are sustainable. I would point out you've been shared with you a copy of a literature review we commissioned from the University of Minnesota to better understand the efficacy of what are called complementary practices in healing trauma in adults. And with veterans, particularly with veterans and interpersonal violence survivors, across the board, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, all reduced. And in many cases, the benefit was sustained beyond the life of a brief intervention. So we have these tools before us, and my strong recommendation is that we start to move beyond a trauma-informed lens into a trauma-healing practice in community model. And we're beginning to develop this framework at the George Family Foundation. I'm very happy to share some of our outcomes. We have community partners in the Somali community, the American Indian community, African American community. They're developing community coaching models that are accepted within the community so that if people who do not wish to be pathologized, if there's stigma around mental health, if they feel that there's someone they can go to, we train in CPR all the time, sort of the frontline response. Why don't we train the barber, the teachers, the community leaders, the faith leaders? Simple skills in how they can help people self-regulate, calm anxiety as an upstream preventive approach to a continuum of care that actually is based on what cultural values are embedded within each community. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Keplinger, for your testimony this morning. Next, we have Catherine Dalnes. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you. I come to you this morning as a representative of our Minnesota State Social Work Association and also the manager of social work services in the Minneapolis Public Schools. I've been a Minneapolis Public School social worker for 26 years. So, you know, I come from these associations representing or supporting the work of the Governor's Task Force on Mental Health as a school social worker, as a school support staff. We certainly share a responsibility and an obligation to support the work of the Governor's Task Force moving forward. We have access to young people birth to 21 on a daily basis, so we have the opportunity to get to know students and their families and build relationships and help students and families who are dealing with issues of mental illness to navigate the system of supports and understand early warning signs, et cetera. So I just want to highlight a couple of the recommendations and why and how we support them. Recommendation one, redefining and transforming the continuum of care. Certainly our work in the schools has shown us the importance of offering a continuum of supports to students at various levels of needs, individual supports, group interventions, consulting with teachers, parent support, collaborating with our on-site school-length therapists. One size certainly does not fit all, and that is certainly our experience in the schools. We support the recommendation to adopt a definition of the mental health continuum of care. In schools, we talk about MTSS, multi-tiered systems of supports. Given the varied mental health needs and functioning of our students, we do need to offer an array of services and support. Some individuals need a little bit of help. Some need much more intensive support. I want to hold out the recommendation to expand transition supports for new immigrants and their families. Certainly our school support staff are often a first point of contact for our new English learner families and for helping them reduce barriers to families. An example, and I think Representative Moran had some questions about our hiring. We just hired a second bilingual, bicultural Central American social worker at Wellstone, which is our school for brand new immigrants aged 17 to 21. We certainly have seen that there's a need for school support staff who speak the language of the students and have an understanding of their immigrant experience. That's critical as these young adults navigate our systems of supports and the education system. The recommendation about using a cultural lens to reduce mental health disparities. We certainly have learned that many community providers maybe lack the cultural knowledge necessary to provide effective services to people from diverse cultural backgrounds. We have certainly seen that not all families, you know, have trust of the mental health system, and so we certainly need to expand our continuum of care to include culturally appropriate interventions for students and families.
Ms. Dulles,
thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony. Next we have Stephen Wickelgren. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Steve Wickelgren, the clinical director with the Minnesota CIT Officers Association. Today I'd like to address some of the issues already brought up, including a great question about the efficacy of the mental health system in general, whether we're talking about medications, therapies, whatever. I have a private practice where I help mostly police officers and other emergency responders. I retired 2-3 years ago from Minneapolis Police Department. I was a police officer and got into the mental health field and supervised the Minneapolis CIT program for the last 13 years of my career there. And one of the perspectives I want to give is that efficacy issue. When we're looking at people's mental health issues and concerns and their success, there's a number of factors. Regarding CIT and what we do in these crisis situations, which are incredibly important in my opinion, the efficacy of CIT is pretty large. Regarding the mentally ill person's success in their mental health in general, I don't know that it has much of an effect. But in that crisis moment, there's plenty of research that shows that injuries to the mentally ill person in that crisis is reduced by at least 50%, including injuries to the police officers when CIT is utilized is reduced. So the success of the program is good in that crisis moment. The perspective I would really like people to understand is the CIT program is not a mental health program. It is, number one, an officer safety program. The number two benefit, which is right behind it is a safety benefit for the person struggling with mental illness. Police officers are not social workers, they're not therapists, they're not mental health providers, but when it becomes a public safety issue, that's where CIT comes into play and is extremely successful. The T in CIT stands for team, and the teamwork is, of course, public safety, working with the mental health community and hospitals and all those other organizations that can benefit it. I agree with Mr. Gove that this specialized training, which it is absolutely specialized, does not belong prior to an officer getting a job, not pre-service. It is post-service because one of the big factors that we look at is the team building. And we need to have that officer, number one, working and understanding the public safety interactions, but number two, they need to be set in that community to understand who those team members are so that they can start working and filling the gaps in the system that are way too wide that people fall into.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wickelgren. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Next, we have Shanna Mobihill. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Shanna Mobihill, and I'm the Executive Director of Mental Health Minnesota. Today, I'm here representing the Mental Health Legislative Network, which is a broad group of more than 30 organizations working on mental health concerns. We'd like to take the opportunity to support the recommendations in the report, but also to offer support of our own that can be utilized as some of these recommendations are undertaken. Creation of a comprehensive mental health continuum of care is essential if we are to meet the needs across the state. And that includes ensuring that people get the level of help they need when they need it. I've heard from so many people who tell me that they were not able to access the help that they needed because they were told they essentially weren't sick enough. This message to people seeking help to manage their mental illness is quite simply at odds with how we approach physical health. If you have cancer, doctors don't tell you to come back when it's stage four. We shouldn't wait until things get really bad to treat mental illness either. We must continue to build our mental health system from early recognition and treatment to crisis services to inpatient treatment to help people move toward recovery faster. Access to mental health services is also an ongoing concern. Developing a mental health workforce is imperative to the delivery of mental health services across the state. In addition, continuing to work toward parity between physical and mental health will help remove barriers that exist for people seeking mental health care and treatment. Stable housing is also an incredibly important issue. In my own organization, many people calling for assistance are having difficulty either finding or maintaining stable housing. And at the end of the day, a person's mental health is, frankly, unlikely to improve until they have a safe and stable place to live. Access to affordable housing, or if there's a need, supportive housing, is essential to improving mental health services across the state as well. The network is particularly interested in a few issues related to increasing access to first episode programs, to school-linked mental health, crisis services, early childhood mental health, and in general, a preventative and proactive approach to mental health. Most of the recommendations encourage a continued effort to support some of the work that's already been done, and we look forward to working with you to keep moving that forward. Right. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Jim Clapper. No, Jim. We have Mary Booklich. Booklich. All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Mary Booklich, and I currently teach at Century College in their law enforcement program. I've been there for about 10 years, and prior to that, I was a police officer and 911 dispatcher. More importantly, I would say my role here is as a family member with someone that throughout that entire time has had a serious and persistent mental illness and many contacts with law enforcement. I wholeheartedly support the intent around the recommendation, specifically Recommendation 9, to improve crisis response education to law enforcement and even law enforcement students. However, I have concerns. I've participated for the past 5 years in the comprehensive revision of the post board's learning objectives. They were referenced by Director Gove, and they do become effective fall 2017. I'd like to acknowledge that there's a success in those, and I'm not sure if the task force was aware of them or not, but for the first time in over 20 years, there are specific and measurable learning outcomes in the post board objectives around responding to mental illness, major mental illness and their signs and symptoms. And beginning this fall, across all schools that offer that degree, that education will be in place, regardless of what this group decides. But I do want to acknowledge I testified 10 years ago in a similar setting, and we didn't have success there. We have to focus on the baby steps, and so beginning fall 17, there will be learning outcomes in all of that law enforcement degree. As it relates to the CIT model, as Mr. Wickelgren commented, it's Crisis Intervention Team, and that's designed to bring the law enforcement officers within their agency and community together with the resources there, as he talked about. Our students, many who can't attend full-time because of their own living situations, may take years to accomplish that two-year degree. Then they have to pass a licensing exam. Then they have to apply for a job. Then they have to get hired. So although I totally support the content within CIT and even CIT as it relates to current police officers in the field, I don't think it will be the most efficient model to use in that pre-service setting for our students that are just learning what it means to be a police officer in our communities. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony this morning. Next, we have Melinda Champ. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Melinda Champ, and I'm here representing Wellness in the Woods, which is Minnesota's statewide consumer network. Our mission is to voice the concerns of Minnesotans living with mental health challenges and fortify opportunities that impact and inspire communities and support systems. Two things. First, we believe it is imperative to support change and the development of our system. But we also believe that the success of any mental health service system have input from consumers, from inception through service provision and evaluation. Second, in response to the task force identified governing principles such as prevention and early intervention and building communities that support resiliency and recovery, we recommend that Minnesota support the development and implementation of new services such as peer respite service programs in Minnesota. Okay. We believe that we are currently seeing people being turned away for support and services on an earlier impact level, as seen through contacts in local emergency rooms, as well as local law enforcement engagement. Often they are being turned away because their level of risk is not high enough to warrant engagement through Medicaid-funded crisis response services, subacute services, and acute hospitalization, often leading to incarceration. This lack of access to earlier community-based prevention is leading to a couple of things. Number one, there is an increased level of loss, damaging trauma, disengagement from family systems, employment, education, and housing in our communities, not to mention a lack of being able to sustain the engagement within mental health services that do make a difference in people's lives. There are now 20 consumer-run staff peer respite services across the United States. Three of them are operational in Wisconsin since 2014. These are home-like facilities run by and for adults with lived experience of mental health and or co-occurring substance use disorders. They serve as short-term residential resource options for up to 5 days and are available 365 24/7. They assist people who have an increase in mental health symptoms or stressors who need some support and supportive service to aid in restabilization and getting back into that path of recovery, thereby averting crises and future losses. It is aligned with transformation efforts focusing on improving quality of care and outcomes for individuals with mental health and co-occurring use disorders. Based upon these findings, we are just requesting that we take a look at studying these options further. I want to thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Sham, for your testimony this morning. Finally, we're going to have Brantley Johnson present, and then Sue Abdeholden was kind enough to wait until Thursday to give her testimony, and we thank her for that. Okay, we don't have Brantley here. We did have two additions at the end, but we do need to get to that sign up this morning. We do need to get to the floor for session, though, so we'll have to take those up at a later time. The committee is adjourned.